on From the Frontline will be covering the question of why I should care about dates in history. Good evening, Dr. Hammond.
Good evening.
So often we hear expressions of exasperation against the teaching of history, and we hear questions asked about things like, why should I care about dates and dead people? And I know, for one, I used to even think like this. So what is the relevance of events that happened long ago? I know you recently wrote something on this, and today specifically being 9/11, that could be a very interesting one. And you say this is even somehow linked to cappuccinos and bagels and croissants.
Quite right, yes. Many people wonder what relevance history has and dates and events of long ago for today. Well, we'll just take 9/11. Today is the 11th of September, what the Americans call 9/11, and 17 years ago, I mean, it doesn't seem that long ago, but 17 years ago, sure, those terrible hijackings and aircraft crashing into the World Trade Center buildings and the Pentagon, and in Pennsylvania, goodness me, how many lives changed as a result of that and our travel. But did those responsible just choose an arbitrary date for those aircraft hijackings and terror attacks on 11th of September 2001? Well, those who know the history of Islamic Jihad can point out that September the 11th is a most significant date for jihadists. It was on the 11th of September 1565 that the Ottoman Turkish siege of Malta was decisively defeated. Now, the Great Siege of Malta was phenomenal. It was one of the greatest battles against all odds, phenomenal courage and resilience of the Knights of St. John. Sultan Suleiman had mobilized the largest armada ever seen, 193 ships, 48,000 fighting men, including 6,000 spies or cavalry, 6,300 of the elite Janissaries, to wipe out the Knights of St. John, to wipe out the Knights off the face of the earth, and to capture the strategic island of Malta for Islam and as a staging post for attacking Southern Europe.
Sure.
To oppose them on the Christian side, there were less than 700 Knights of St. John.
Wow.
400 Spanish soldiers, 800 Italian soldiers, 200 Greek and Sicilian soldiers, and approximately 3,000 untrained militia from the Maltese population. So along with other civilians are given weapons, a total force of less than 9,000 men, of which barely 1,000 were trained soldiers. And they were going to face 48,000 of the best that the Ottoman Empire had to throw at them.
Sure, 9,000 against 48,000.
Yes, but having said that, the Knights of St. John were respected as the toughest soldiers in Christendom. They were in the very front line of the battle to keep safe Europe from Islamic jihadists. So in all, in the 4 months of furious fighting, the Great Siege of Malta, 130,000 cannonballs were fired from the Turkish artillery.
Sure.
130,000 cannonballs against the Christian defenders of Malta. The siege lasted from the 18th of May to the 11th of September.
Surprise, surprise.
1565. The Turks lost over 30,000 men in their futile attempt to overwhelm the tiny Christian garrison on Malta. And the day the Muslims were chased off Malta when they fled the shores was 11th of September, 1565.
Wow.
So maybe the attackers at 9/11 were trying to choose a date that was of immense significance to jihadists.
Mm-hmm.
Next, there was the Great Siege of Vienna. Now, Vienna was not just on the outskirts of Europe. That was at the heart of Europe. I mean, Vienna was the capital of the Holy Roman Empire, effectively. And so the great threat, the last great Turkish Ottoman Empire threat to the heart of Europe, was defeated at the gates of Vienna on the 11th of September, 1683. And the siege of Vienna began 14 July, 1683. It's recognized as the high water mark of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. They threatened the very heartland of Europe. An Ottoman Turkish Empire of 300,000 men included 12,000 of the elite Janissaries.
Sure.
The relief force of Bavarian, Saxon, and Polish forces routed the Ottoman Turkish forces who were besieging Vienna, and the Ottoman Turks lost 60,000 men in the siege, of which 40,000 Turks died on the last day of the battle, 11th of September 1683,
wow,
when the Polish king led the charge, and he was an old man by then, but I think he was in his 70s, but he charged at the front of the cavalry, and it went straight through the Turkish lines, slaughtered him. Now, to celebrate the defeat of the Turks at the Battle of Vienna, the bakers of Vienna designed the croissant, the crescent-shaped pastry, to commemorate the victory of Christian forces over the jihadists of Islam. And as the bakers put it, they had the Turks for breakfast. Indeed.
Interesting.
Before anyone had breakfast, the Turks were attacked by the Polish-led cavalry. And so it was the Vienna-born queen, Queen Mary Antoinette, mm-hmm. the famous Mary Antoinette of France, who introduced the croissant to France. Hence, the name is in a French name now. The crescent-shaped pastry, which started in Vienna, was brought to Paris, was renamed the croissant in Paris in 1770 by Queen Mary Antoinette when she married the Dauphin of France, who later became King Louis the 16th.
Wow.
The fatal one. But there was another antidote, and that is the Viennese discovered many bags of coffee in the abandoned Ottoman encampment. The Turks had fled and they didn't need the coffee anymore. So a very enterprising Capuchin friar, Marco de Avianto, opened up a coffee shop in Vienna. The name of this first coffee house was opened by Franciszek Kulczyński, and they invented cappuccino, named after the Capuchin friar, Marco de Avianto, who had found these bags of coffee and thought, well, let's open up a coffee shop. And they had adaptation specifically because of all the looted coffee that was left behind, hence cappuccinos.
Cappuccino.
Capuchin fry. Then the bakers also designed a new type of pastry in the shape of horse stirrups. And they presented these bagels to the king of the Poles, King Jan Soboski, who had led the charge. And because this was the victorious cavalry charge that broke the Turkish lines, they fashioned the bagel in the form of a stirrup, presented it to King Soboski, and hence we now have today the bagels.
Sure, that is so fascinating.
Dating back to 1683, Vienna, siege of Vienna, the uplifting of the siege of Vienna, defeat of the Ottoman Turks, all on 11th of September.
Wow. So history really is linked to very important things like cappuccinos.
yes, and bagels and croissants. And I'm disappointed to see that croissants are being made more and more in a kind of elongated form instead of a crescent shape. I know that's easier, but they really should keep to the shape of the crescent. That's what's called a croissant.
For sure, yeah.
So, you know, when you have your croissant, remember Siege of Vienna.
Fabulous. I'll definitely do that each time I drink a cappuccino from now on.
Well, so, there are other dates too.
Yes. What are some examples of other dates that follow the same example?
Okay, so take 28th of June 1914.
Yeah.
The shots that sparked the First World War. It was on the 28th of June 1914 that the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, one of the greatest empires in the world, which had kept Europe safe for centuries against the Turks. They were Ostrogoths, the Eastern Empire, that protected Europe from the Ottoman Turks, such as at the Siege of Vienna.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Now the heir to the great Austro-Hungarian Empire, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and his beloved wife Sophie, were on that date celebrating their 14th wedding anniversary, 28th of June 1914, and they were going on that date for a visit to Sarajevo. Now, they should have studied the history a bit better, or the security people should have, because for hundreds of years, Sarajevo had been under Ottoman Turkish Muslim rule. And the Austrians had liberated Bosnia and Herzegovina from the Ottoman Turkish Empire in 1878. And so the date chosen by the Archduke Franz Ferdinand to go to Sarajevo was a date of painful historic significance for Serbs. It was the anniversary of their most disastrous defeat at the hands of the Ottoman Turks at the Battle of Kosovo, 28th of June 1389. Okay, that's a long time ago, but the people there remembered it. It's a very painful memorial date. So the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife, celebrating the 14th wedding anniversary on the same day, 28th June 1914, The security services should have noted the danger of a state visit of the heir to the Austrian throne to such a volatile, cosmopolitan, half-oriental city as Kosovo, particularly on such a sensitive, highly symbolic date as the anniversary of the Battle of Kosovo, a rallying point for Serb nationalists, and they're going to the capital of Kosovo, effectively, there, which is Sarajevo. I mean, today, many of us now know the name Sarajevo. We know the name Bosnia, because the wars were carrying on there until very recently. So when people question whether dates and dead people in history are of any relevance to us today, you need to remember the most disastrous war in history started on that date because of security people not paying attention to history and choosing or not minding or objecting to the choosing of a date that was the kind of date that any Serb nationalist would have looked to. Oh, this is a perfect time to have an assassination. It's symbolic for our cause.
Yeah.
And so in history, we can see examples of man's depravity and rebellion against God. And we can also see dates and examples of God's mercy and grace and sovereignty and intervening in the course of human events. So everything has significance. Ideas have consequences. Dates have significance. Yeah. And history provides us with the visions of those who impacted society for good and ill, and examples of excellence to inspire us to courageously stand firm in spite of opposition. So we need to learn from the mistakes of others and to benefit from the painstaking development and sacrifice of the past. Because as Cicero said over 2,000 years ago, to be ignorant of what happened before you were born is to remain a child forever.
Mm-hmm.
And Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great Russian author of the 20th century, he wrote, "If we do not know our own history, we'll simply have to endure the same mistakes, the same sacrifices, the same absurdities all over again.
Absolutely.
If we don't learn from history, we repeat its mistakes."
For sure.
George Santa Anna said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it."
Yeah, sure. That is truly tragic. So, Dr. Hammond, what makes you, being a missionary, interested in history?
Well, there's quite a number of reasons for that. One thing is, I was brought up in a fascinating time and country, Rhodesia. And at school in Rhodesia, I was often at loggerheads with other students and some of the teachers because I supported the Boers and argued that Britain was the aggressor in Anglo-Boer wars. And this wasn't a popular position for an English-speaking student at a Rhodesian school at Milton Junior and Milton High School. And the principals at both schools used to proclaim, "We're more British than the British." And our textbooks all came from England. And their perceptions of South African history was, to my opinion, unbalanced and unfair.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I at that stage didn't know any Afrikaans people. None of our family friends were Afrikaans, but I had a love of reading. And I was a regular visitor to the Bulawayo Library. And The Washing of the Spears by Donald Morris, excellent history on the Zulus, and Hill of Doves by Stuart Clutie, and The First Boer War by Joseph Lehman, and Commando by Dennis Reitz, all convinced me of the fighting qualities of the Boer and that we'd been on the wrong side in these wars. So even from 12 years old, I remember arguing at school, in junior school, on that, because I thought I saw in history another side to what they were teaching me in the classrooms. But then my father had fought all 6 years of the Second World War in the Royal Artillery, mostly in the Eighth Army, much of that North African desert. And he had a high respect for Field Marshal Erwin Rommel and of the German Afrika Korps. And he had a disdain for Hollywood films. So my father would see some war film and he'd say, "It wasn't like that." Or, "I don't believe it." Or, "That's not true." It's just the odd comment here and there, which made me think, now, he fought in the war and he's scorning a lot of the films about the war. And sometimes I remember discussing and asking some questions and I'm saying, "You know, the Germans were an honorable people. They were gentlemen. So there was no atrocity in North Africa." And he'd speak about how they had celebrated Christmas together with the Afrika Korps, singing Christmas carols, coming out, shaking hands, playing soccer together, swapping ration packs.
Sure.
And how there was an unspoken understanding of a ceasefire after any battle to walk past one another and pick up and stretch as you're wounded, and their medics would be helping our guys and our medics would be helping their guys. And then as a very young boy, I was probably only five, I remember when my grandfather came to visit, and my grandfather had fought in Africa Corps. He was on the German side. And so you can imagine the confusion of my brother and I. Dad and Granddad used to fight one another. What's going to happen? And so we wondered if there's going to be a battle in the living room or something. And they embraced, and they, like brothers, and it was extraordinary. And you could see my father's deep respect. I never saw my dad express such respect for other people. But for his enemy, his previous enemy,
sure,
my grandfather. Now, I'm also wanting to know, why were my dad and grandfather fighting? Why was my mom getting bombed in Berlin when she was a six-year-old? She went through a lot of aerial bombardments, and she didn't make much of it, but you could tell it had obviously had an impact. That's one reason why she had moved out to Africa, to get away from Europe because of the World Wars, the two World Wars. So she was born in 1934. My mom was six when the World War started. She went through about 60 aerial bombardments, including 1,000 bomber raids in Berlin. And, you know, I'm wanting to know, why did my mom go through that? And why did my dad experience the things he did? And why was he so scornful of the films? And typical male, he didn't talk much and didn't talk much about that. But occasionally I could get a little bit out. So that made me want to know. And then why is it that Rhodesia is fighting communism and terrorism, and yet Britain is putting us under sanctions? Why is it that we fought for Britain in the First and Second World War in the Malayan conflict, Rhodesia, I mean, but now Rhodesia's under attack and the British are helping our enemies and they're sanctioning us, and some of the British weapons ending up on the other side and they're informing the other side. In fact, I discovered later on from Ian Smith, the Prime Minister of Rhodesia, who I first met when I was 14, so as a 14-year-old boy here, the Prime Minister's come at the Bulawayo Club, which my dad ran. So I'm waiting outside, expect to see something impressive. And along comes, when it's first time seeing a head of state, and I'm expecting something like what I saw on, you know, the Queen and Buckingham Palace. And along comes this beat-up old Peugeot 404, rattle trap, actually, and out steps the Prime Minister. He was driving himself. There was no bodyguard. There was no chauffeur. There was no policeman anywhere around, no aide-de-camp. The Prime Minister in a time of war is driving himself in a really humble car, a pre-1965 car, which means it was over 11 years old. And he's in a car that was before sanctions. He didn't get himself a better car, which he could have imported, because he was at the same level as the rest of society. I was told that he would sometimes cycle to work as the Prime Minister to save fuel, because everyone was trying to save fuel. We're under sanctions. And he stroked my cat sitting on the wall. He smiled at me and he walked upstairs. And I'm like, this is not what I expected. And later I had a chance to meet with him for the last 20 years of his life. We met every year sometimes for lunch and supper and tea. And I interviewed him on radio. And I found real insights. So now you're wanting to know, why were we being attacked by our allies and enemies? And how come Britain wasn't on our side when we were fighting communist terrorists and murdering missionaries, murdering school children, landmines and roads? And I wanted to know why. And we were short of a whole lot of things. And when I went to Victoria Falls to see the Victoria Falls for the first time, very, very big impact in my life. And I look at this magnificent Victoria Falls, and they're talking about just a few months before, two Canadian girls had stood there and were shot dead by Zambian soldiers on the other side, who shot across the Zambezi River at them just because they're white, not knowing they were Canadian, which caused big trouble. But Canada was supporting the terrorists and was sanctioning us. And they continued to, even afterwards, the people who'd shot their own people. And you don't want to know, why would people just want to shoot them just because they're white? Just because they're on the southern side of the Zambezi River? This doesn't make sense. And so I got a great interest in history early on. I would go to the library and I'd come back with four, five, six books piled up there, and maximum I could borrow. And I'd go through the whole lot. And as a youngster, I was devouring books, particularly history books. And I wanted to know why it was like it was. Also, one of the first films that made a big impact on me was the Man from U.N.C.L.E. series. And the Man from U.N.C.L.E. was like pre-Glasnost, Glasnost. There you had the United Nations having two secret agents, and one secret agent was American, the other was Russian. They were working together to keep the world safe for democracy, and they were working for UNCLE, the United Nations. So the UN are the good guys, according to the film. But in my class were some children who came from the Congo, Belgian Congo. And they said, no, no, the UN are not the good guys. The UN bombed our town of Elizabethville. They looted our home. They stole our things when we were fleeing. We even had our property stolen at the UN roadblocks before we could cross into Northern Rhodesia to come in. So now I've got a problem. My dad fought in the war, and he doesn't believe the films on the Second World War. I'm watching films that show the UN the good guy, but some other children at school are saying, no, they're the people who looted our things, stole our things, bombed our home, and all the rest of it. So I've got to make a decision. I mean, who do I trust? Do I trust people I know and love, like my father? Or do I trust cocaine-sniffing drug addicts and child abusers in Hollywood?
Yeah, sure. And then you have even written your own history books. How did you then get into writing your own history books?
Well, that's quite a story too, because as I've been homeschooling my children, I've got four children, and I've been involved in homeschooling actually for 27 years.
Wow.
And so loved her homeschooling. And of course, naturally, now my wife's a trained teacher, especially in phys ed. So she's majored in phys ed. Our children have done every kind of ice skating, through long distance running and Irish dancing and you name it, gymnastics, through to the water polo, hockey, the whole thing. So it seems that our children have been majoring in phys ed. But I was given history, naturally, to teach our children English, history, and geography.
Well,
I've traveled 37 countries, four continents. So geography is fun, history is fun. Well, as I was going through the generally good textbooks, you'd find mistakes. And I'd pull out my pen and I'd be crossing out and correcting dates, places, sequence events, sometimes crossing out whole sections like, no, no, that's rubbish. And now my first daughter, Andrea, she had no problem. You know, dad's correcting the history book, didn't seem to bother her. My second daughter, Daniela, was horrified. How can the textbook be wrong?
Yeah.
And I'd say, well, governments write most textbooks and they've often got an agenda. And in fact, my first history teacher at school, Mr. Rhys Davies, was also a member of parliament in Rhodesia. And back then, you didn't get paid for being a member of parliament or being a town council or a mayor. It was an honorary position. You donated your time and energy and service. So normally people had to have a real job as well as being a member of parliament or something.
A real job.
It wasn't a means of enriching yourself because there was no financial remuneration. In fact, I remember our teacher saying, if he wants to fly to Salisbury from Bulawayo, he had to pay for his own ticket. He only had a free train ticket.
Sure.
For being a member of parliament. You got a train voucher, not a plane. If you want to fly, your own expense. Anyway, the first thing my history teacher said to me, beware the victor's version. Wartime propaganda morphs into peacetime textbooks. There's a department of propaganda during the war to put the enemy in the worst light and your own force in the best light and build up morale and cover over errors, mistakes, defeats, and so on and so forth. And he said, there's not a ministry of truth during peacetime to rectify the errors. You've got to be very, very critical. Always think outside the box. Never regurgitate the textbook. Always ask why. And that's just good advice. But now I'm going through the history books and my daughter's saying, why are you correcting the textbook? How can the textbook be wrong? And I've got to say, well, Daniela, I grew up in Rhodesia. I know Ian Smith. I've met General Walls. I know a lot of the people who are involved in the war. This person who wrote this book couldn't have even been to Rhodesia. He couldn't have written this if he'd known. I was involved in the war in Southwest Africa. I was involved in the war in Angola. I was in Rwanda. I've walked in the killing fields of Rwanda. I've been in the prison ministering to the very Interahamwe who were the genocidal maniacs killing the people with machetes. I was involved in Sudan. I've seen the war in Sudan. I've travelled around Eastern Europe. I've travelled from Poland and north through Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Albania, Yugoslavia in the south. I know Yugoslavia. I know many of the people. I've met the people involved in the Civil War. I know some of the people who were in solidarity in Poland and Russians and Ukrainians, friends of mine, giving me what happened to the persecuted church. So I know from my own limited personal experience of travel a whole lot of these things that they're writing about in the textbook, I know to be false because I was there and I know the people concerned. And some of these things are in my lifetime. Well, sometimes you find some things that's out of your lifetime.
How do you know that you're right?
Right. But So it's like a detective story. You've got to look at the clues. Now, sometimes something doesn't fit, and that's in Sherlock Holmes. Mm-hmm. Something doesn't fit, and he's looking, and he's trying to find until every piece fits.
Mm.
And he tries to work out what's the most likely scenario. So if you find some forensic evidence that clashes with your interpretation, you've got to start to reevaluate your interpretation.
Mm.
So, for example, if you're up in the mountain and you're convinced you're on this path and so on, and next thing you come across a cairn, there's a pile of rocks and a sign that says Plutagriff Gorge. Well, I thought I was in Skeleton Gorge, and this is saying I'm in Plutagriff Gorge. What do you trust more, your perception or the physical objective cairn, this objective rock evidence in front of you? Well, you've got to assume that your perception was at fault. You're faced with some physical evidence that you're not where you thought you were. Now, that happens in history too. So, for example, I was born 1960. So, I was, of course, born 15 years after the Second World War. But I know people who were in the Second World War. I've met people who fought in the First World War. They're not alive now, but I knew people who fought in the First World War. I spoke with people in the old age home who had been in the Anglo-Boer War. And I spoke with a lady who was locked up in one of the concentration camps and got the insights. I even spoke to a man when I was a child in Rhodesia who came up in 1890 with Cecil Rhodes in the pioneer column that settled Rhodesia in 1890. Now, interesting, you often think of that's a long time ago, but it was in the lifetime of people that we've overlapped with. So, because I like books, I look for secondhand bookshops, because to be honest, what you get in the average bookshop today is modern books, and it's politically correct, and they've edited and they've abbreviated, and a lot of the things that they're giving you are not actually the really true and interesting things from them. For example, David Livingstone, great missionary, a hero of ours. We've named our mission house Livingstone House. Well, I've found all of his original first-hand books, and we're talking about first editions, published in 1856 and so on. So I've got these books. Now, you start to go through it, you find things you've never heard before, because the modern books leave out the fact that he had a double-barreled rifle and a six-barreled revolver, and that he used these weapons to free the slaves. Somehow that doesn't make it into the modern abridged, politically correct versions, or that he is a Calvinist. You know, you'll read about William Carey founded the Baptist Missionary Society. Well, he didn't call it that. He called the particular Calvinist Baptist Missionary Society for the Propagation of the Gospel Amongst the Heathen. That was the name of the missionary society he found. That's interesting, because why did they abbreviate it today? Well, you don't want to confuse people with too many facts. And so they simplify things. And the eschatology of victory, the post-millennial vision that inspired missionaries like William Carey or David Livingstone, it's expunged from the modern books. A lot of the clashes that they had with mission leaders and political leaders and some of the backstabbing character assassins that were involved in the field with them who deserted the field, that doesn't make it in the modern books, because maybe that'll make people feel awkward. But it's history. It's fact. We should take what's there. And the fact that David Livingstone's wife, Mary Livingstone, died in the Zambezi Valley, it's mentioned in some history books, but they don't mention why. Some of the porters of David Livingstone decided this box is a bit heavy, this medicine chest, and emptied the medicines into the Zambezi River. So when she got malaria, they had no quinine to treat her. Now that's an unpleasant fact to know, so most modern ones cut it out.
Just chop it out.
So to get to know the people, the situations, and understand things, I find if you can get to the old books, the original books. We had in this boardroom a Hospital Christian Fellowship meeting where there's a whole lot of leaders, and one of the people had just done a t-shirt which they put on there, only one life will soon be passed, only what's done for God will last. And I said, but that's not the quote. The quote was only what's done for Christ will last, now that put God. And she said, no, well, she checked on Wikipedia, and they said that was the original quote. And I said, no, the original quote.
Wikipedia, that anyone can
only
write.
What's done for Christ will last is what C.T. Studd said. No, but she said, I checked in Wikipedia. I said, well, I got my doctorate in 19th century missiology and the 19th century missionary movement. And I've got the first edition books here of C.T. Studd, books published in the 19th century by him. And what he said was, only what's done for Christ will last. No, she said, I checked in Wikipedia. I said, no, but Wikipedia does not
adjust.
It cannot be a higher authority than an original, first edition, 19th century book from... No, but I checked Wikipedia. And you're just thinking, can people not see the difference between... Mm. If you want to check that something's true, you don't say, I know what happened. I saw a film in Hollywood that said, inspired by real events.
Mm.
Which means some of this might have happened. Most of it's been changed. So you can't take Wikipedia or Hollywood film over a first edition book from that era written by an eyewitness. And this is the problem. I think we've got a lot of people today who think, it's got to be true. I saw it in Wikipedia. I know it's true because I saw it in this Hollywood film that came out last year.
The Pearl Harbor movie.
Yes. Now I know what happened at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And I mean, just take Pearl Harbor movie. So there's this American fighter pilot who is sent over to Britain to fight in the Royal Air Force. Why did America not have its own needs and its own problems? And he somehow is able to come back and join, and he's there just in time for the Pearl Harbor attack. And these two fighter pilots, these two friends, they end up going up and they shoot down the planes and so on. Okay. And then they're also on the Doolittle raid flying bombers off this aircraft carrier. Now, anyone who knows military has got to know, a fighter pilot is not a bomber pilot. Fighter command and bomber command are two completely separate groups. And then the Navy is completely different. The Navy's got its own pilots.
Mm.
Naval aviators are not Army pilots. You wouldn't have had two Army fighter pilots suddenly made bomber pilots on a naval... So they've changed arms of the services. And they've changed... Why would you put fighter pilots to fly bombers off an aircraft carrier, which is completely different skill set and training and experience. But to keep the same people in it, they did that. There was the Four Feathers movie where you had these officers who started out cavalry. Next thing you know, they're Camel Corps. And before you know it, they're commanding infantry at this battle of Abu Klea. And you think, there's no way a cavalry officer will become a Camel Corps, will become an infantry officer. Anyone knows the military knows, you don't do that. It's not possible. They would have stayed within their discipline, within their particular rank and core. You didn't have cross-training like this. So sometimes Hollywood has a film and you can think, okay, well, maybe it's just for the story, continuity.
It's a beautiful, romantic, tragic storyline, but it's not Pearl Harbor.
No. My father-in-law, who was US Air Force, US Navy, he said, when I mentioned Pearl Harbor, he said, oh, you mean the romance pretending to be a war movie?
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, it's a romance.
Which is fine, but don't name it Pearl Harbor. But that's strategically misleading. Most people think,
I know about Pearl Harbor because I saw the film. And actually, there's a lot of inaccuracies in that film.
And it's strategic. It's not accidental.
Yes. And there's much worse. I mean, that's actually pretty trivial.
Yes,
but just to illustrate the point. Mm. So, no, when it comes to how can I know what's true, eyewitnesses are helpful. Documentation, archaeological evidence, manuscripts, eyewitness accounts, all of these help. But then you want cross-referencing for something really controversial. And when you get your enemy saying the same thing as an opponent, then that's pretty hard. So, for example, when at the trial of Nelson Mandela, for example, Rivonia trial, that he admitted that the manuscript, How to Be a Good Communist, was his, and it is in his handwriting. So it was uncontested evidence. So the prosecution said, we found the 64-page document, How to Be a Good Communist, written by Nelson Mandela, and he accepted that he had written it. So it wasn't a contested item. Mm. Well, now you've got pretty good confirmation. Mandela said he wrote it, and so did the others. So now, at that point, you can say that's pretty settled.
Mm.
And that was accepted in court evidence and not contested for the rest of his life, even till the day he died. And interestingly enough, when he did die, all the people around him, family and so on, all said he always was a senior member of the Southern Communist Party. So during his life, he claimed for over 50 years, I'm not a communist. Okay, I wrote that book, How to Be a Good Communist, but I'm not a communist. That's just academic. But then later they said, no, he always was a senior member of the Southern Communist Party. So you've got his writings, you've got his life, you've got what he did, you've got his friends. And then the Southern Communist Party later said, for strategic purposes, we didn't let it be known that he was a senior member of the Politburo, the Southern Communist Party, but now we can.
Mm.
And so, well, now that's established fact. You've gone from a theory to evidence to conclusive.
Mm.
And so it must be on everything. So there's got to be a bit of a Sherlock Holmes detective in a historian to try and find what really is the truth underneath it all.
Yeah, but that's also in itself is, as you say, not a wanted fact, and so it's looked over. And like you were saying earlier, what was very interesting is that you said that your textbooks in Rhodesia when you were at school were from the UK.
Yes.
And what's terrifying now is that South Africa is wanting to make history a compulsory subject in schools. Which would be great if it was true history, but they'll obviously not be teaching history at all. And I was reading about it, the task team that established, that was established by the Basic Education Department was, it was established in 2015, and that was after there was a perceived lack of knowledge of the country's history among learners, which I fully agree, but state-provided education definitely won't be teaching them actual South African history in these compulsory lessons. So why should the government be involved in shaping the minds of future voters? I can tell you they definitely don't have the children's best interests at heart. So that's a very big, big problem as well.
Yes, well, Karl Marx, who many of these government people read like the Bible,
mm-hmm.
Karl Marx said the first battlefield is the rewriting of history.
Mm.
And Karl Marx's comrades have been very busy with distortion, disinformation, indoctrination, and propaganda. I would say most of the news media, most of the entertainment industry, and most of the educational institutions are less than useless when it comes to understanding the times and knowing what really happened and why.
Mm-hmm.
There is a pervasive hostility to Christianity growing throughout the Western world. And it's so important that we need to cross-check. For example, as a missionary, as I began to travel across borders, my understanding of history and of the world had to change dramatically. My Christian friends in Eastern Europe challenged my understanding of world history. In Poland, they told me about Katyn. Well, according to our history books, the German army had killed all the Polish officers in Katyn Forest. And they said, oh, don't tell us you believe the propaganda. And they said, where's Katyn? Find it in a map. Show me a map. And you know, I'd never seen a map of where Katyn is. And I was looking. I said, over there. No, more east. Look at Smolensk. Look close to Smolensk, which is deep in Russia. Oh, there's Katyn. No wonder they never showed us a map of where Katyn was. It was deep in Soviet territory. Well, why did they blame the Germans for it instead of the Soviets, when everyone knew it was the Russian Soviets who had done it, and the Poles always knew, and now even the Soviets have had to admit it and evidence has come out.
Mm.
But it took over 70 years for it to come out. Well, the reason was because at that time, Britain was at war with Germany and allied with Russia, and they were also allied with Poland, so it was convenient to say that the Poles were killed by the Germans, they're our enemy, not by the Russians who are allies. And do you know that when this came out, the Polish commander-in-chief, who was also head of the government in exile of Poland, he was actually assassinated by the British in 1943 at Gibraltar. And he was threatening the alliance between the British, the Americans, and the Russians, the Soviets, the communists who are running Soviet Union. And so there is the murder of the general. It's absolutely shocking. Katyn. Then you've got Yalta, the Yalta Agreement. Well, Yalta, everyone in Eastern Europe knew about that, because that's when the big three, Churchill of England, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or FDR of America, and Stalin of the Soviet Union, agreed on the boundaries, and where basically the West betrayed the whole of Eastern Europe. 150 million Christians, 10 nations behind the Iron Curtain. Absolutely shocking. Well, I didn't know about that. I mean, I thought, you know, we fought for freedom and democracy and we were the good guys and we never did atrocities and, you know, we were like knights in shining armor. And my friends in Eastern Europe didn't see it that way. And they told me things that I never could have believed. And it was beyond shocking. And to speak to the people in Eastern Europe who'd been in the concentration camps, and Richard von Braun's a friend of our family, and Brother Andrew's a good friend, and I've had meals with him and met him multiple times over the years, and we've corresponded. So, of course, they've got a very different view of history, because we know things from a Western perspective, but the church in Eastern Europe has a very different way of thinking.
Mm.
Do you know that there were soldiers of the Ukrainian army fighting in the field in company strength as late as 1955. 10 years after the Second World War, the Ukrainian army was still fighting against the Red Army of the Soviets, and they were always waiting for some aid from the West, which never came.
Sure.
The Lithuanian army was fighting in the forest to platoon strength as late as 1954, 9 years after the Second World War.
Wow.
And the resistance throughout. And yet, what do we see on our side? Picture of a Russian soldier, he fights for freedom. He's our friend. Literally, there's propaganda posters of Second World War, and unbelievable. So I'm afraid travel forces you to change your mind. And again, seeing what happened in Rwanda and hearing what the United Nations role was in disarming the people and standing back and doing nothing and handing over people who are in their hands for protection, handing them over to the Interahamwe mass murderers. I've had to rethink and rewrite every aspect of world history. You've got to double check your sources, research the evidence, identify trustworthy sources, cross check references. Mm-hmm. Where's the hard physical evidence? Has forensics been done? Do the numbers add up? Sometimes that's. And then what's the fruit? You can often see, once you start doing that kind of forensic research, I've had the privilege of meeting people like Ian Paisley of Northern Ireland, top leader, who really kept Northern Ireland from being betrayed in the hands of the IRA by the British government. He said to me when I came to his pulpit, "We understand what happened to Rhodesia. What the British Foreign Office did to you is what the British Home Office is trying to do to us.
Wow.
Betray us."
Yeah.
And General Constantine, who is head of the South African Defence Force at one stage, has been in our home. And Colonel Jan Breitenmark's been a good friend. He's joined our mission. Founder of 3-2 Battalion, the reconnaissance commander, a veteran of over 50 battles behind enemy lines, phenomenal hero. General Ben Parton, who invented a lot of the precision-guided weapons of the US Air Force. George Verver, one of the greatest missionaries of modern times, founder of Operation Mobilization. And one of my mentors was Professor Fritz Haus. Now, this is a man who fought all through the Second World War, first in the Eastern Front, then also in North Africa and Africa Corps. And he was a professor of Old Testament. I mean, what a man. He had Bible studies and prayer meetings throughout the time and army. Dr. James Kennedy, Reverend Erlo Stegen, leader of the most successful mission on the planet, Kwasi Bantu Mission. So meeting so many history makers, travel, research, first-hand eyewitness testimony from reliable witnesses, I've learned never to trust Hollywood and never to trust the politicization of history.
Yeah. So then how can, or what advice can you give to our listeners on discernment, on how to know what is true and what's not?
Well, yes, we must be really careful. It's not just a matter of choosing Christian history books. I'm afraid when it comes to history, a lot of Christian history books from Christian curriculum providers seem to be just the secular history books with their selection of events, their selection of people, their selection of even identification and sequences and lessons, just put in a Christian history book with a verse added and maybe a prayer. And,
exactly.
You know, baptizing secular history doesn't make it Christian.
Mm.
So I've been very discouraged by a lot of the history books, especially that come from America, because America must be one of the most propagandized, brainwashed countries on the planet. Their media is so sophisticated in disinformation that I'm while I like a lot of the textbooks we get from America, from Christian curriculum providers and mathematics and so on, when it comes to history, not happy. There's been a few good books that have come out of America recently, but they're not Christian school textbooks. Freedom Betrayed, which was suppressed for over 60 years, but that was from President of America Herbert Hoover, who wrote A Secret History of America's Involvement in the Second World War and its Aftermath.
Sure.
Freedom Betrayed, suppressed, now out by the Hoover Institute. This is Herbert Hoover, President of America, showing how the US government was involved in the most treacherous ways in orchestrating the Second World War, initiating, getting the Poles and the British and the French involved for nefarious purposes. And he exposes the Cold War and all the things involved in America's hand in it. So that's from an American president, Herbert Hoover.
Mm.
And Pat Buchanan has written Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, how Britain lost her empire and the West lost the world. Very good history book from a man who used to be a key advisor for Ronald Reagan. And so there are some good books that have come out there. But most I've been finding from Europe and especially behind Iron Curtain, Christians like, of course, Alexander Solzhenitsyn and so on, giving us a wonderful insight, which I'm afraid in the West we do not have. So I've written a bunch of history books as a result. I started off with the Greatest Century of Missions and then the Greatest Century of Reformation, 16th and 19th century history, and then Victorious Christians Who Changed the World, which takes a full sweep of 20 centuries. It's got 32 biographies. I think the best way to learn history is often from biographies. So I've tended to take a biographical approach, lots of illustrations, lots of sketches, lots of the original maps and pictures, and where possible, good photographs. And sketches from South African history follows the same format of again, lots of biographies and so on. And I've also done slavery, terrorism and Islam, faith and defiance, Sudan. So these are just some of the history books I've produced. Those are six of them. And there's also written on Mozambique and Rwanda. To me, our ministry that we started, Christian Liberty Books, is trying to provide good resources for home educators.
Mm-hmm.
You notice we don't use the word homeschooler as much, because school is something the state may do. You can be educated without schooling.
Mm-hmm.
You can be schooled without being educated.
So we like to
speak about home education as opposed to schooling, because we don't necessarily do everything in desks and rows and formalities and ringing bells. So we may not school our children, but we educate them if we give them a love for reading and a love for books, and we take them to the museums and the monuments and the battle sites, which I've had the joy of doing. So in Cape Town, we actually take our people on guided tours of the castle, the oldest building in the Southern Hemisphere still standing.
Mm-hmm.
And we take our people to the oldest mission station like Carnarvon in Africa, in Southern Africa. We'll take them to monuments, battle sites. I've gone to Blood River battle site, climbed Mount Majuba with my son. You know, there's nothing better than going to the actual places, the Anglo-Boer War Museum and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then for those people who can't get there, we've put together our audiovisual, PowerPoint sets, videos, and of course the books like Sketches from South African History.
Mm-hmm.
A great emphasis on the Reformation and the Reformation 500. Well, we've now got a whole audiovisual on the videos and audios, and actually going to Wittenberg and to the other key historic sites and documenting and being able to put it all together in the most illustrated way possible.
Mm-hmm.
So if people are interested, a lot of my history lectures are on our sermon audio on our frontlinemissionsa.org web. We've got more and more videos of presentations given to the Reformation Society that's available on our frontlinemissionsa.org website.
Mm-hmm.
I'm putting as many history articles as possible on the reformationsa.org website. But then for people who say, well, I'd like to have the curriculum in hand, well, through Christian Liberty Books, we're making the books available and audiovisual box sets, such as on Reformation 500 and on South African history and so on. We are making sure that it's got the audios, it's got the videos, it's got the lecture notes, it's got the PDFs of the book, it's got the PowerPoints. A whole range of things. So basically, we're trying to put people a whole curriculum that they can teach their children from history from reliable sources. And I'm always looking for more reliable resources from people we know, we trust, or we find something exceptional. And so if people go onto our christianlibertybooks.co.za website, they'll find some amazing things, like from economists like Stephen Whitford Goodson and history books he's written on Smuts and on Henrik Voigt and so on, just amazing in the history of central banking. To understand economics from the perspective of someone who thought outside the box and dared to say, is this the right way of doing things? I'd say we're still on an adventure of trying to find good, reliable resources and produce them where necessary. So contact us, look on our website, frontlinemissionsa.org, reformationsa.org.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Dr. Hammond. History tells us what has worked and what has not, and we need to develop the ability to recognize these lessons in every area of life, and it's important that we discover our roots. And in history we can see examples of excellence and illustrations of man's depravity and rebellion against God, and God's mercy as well, his grace and his sovereignty in intervening in the course of human events. But as we heard today, it definitely is very important to know our history. So thank you very much, Dr. Hammond. Good evening.